two matters before us. We will be starting with a briefing on the insurance laws amendment bill. And after that, we'll deliberate on the financial management of Parliament bill. To take us through the briefing on the insurance laws amendment bill, we have from National Treasury, Mr. Ismail Mamoniat, who is the DDG Tax, Finance, and International Economics. Good morning, Mr. Mamoniat. And Ms. Joanne Ferreira, who literally lives here, and she's going to be on the list when members make their nominations next for the next elections. And Mr. Baron Furstenberg, who I have learned not to call a young man anymore because I've seen the signs that... Yeah. I'm just following up on whether it is not the guy. And then Ms. Catherine Gibson for the Senior Economist Financial Services. Good morning and welcome. And from the Financial Services Board, we have Mr. Jonathan Dixon, who has just jumped ship. Mr. Dixon. How can you do that? The last time we met with this man, he was sitting on the other side of the fence. This time around is, yeah, but welcome and, yeah, congratulations on your new appointment. Okay, my apologies. I had requested that this be dealt with, and apparently. There's some technological challenges. Yeah, Mr. Jonathan Dixon, Deputy Executive Officer, Insurance with the Financial Services Board. And, okay, and we also have Ms. Suzette Fokasan, is that correct? Yeah, Head Insurance Prudential Department. And Ms. Jackie Huma, Head Insurance Compliance Department. And Mr. Billy Clark, Senior Specialist in Insurance. Good morning and welcome. We also have Mr. Sisa Makabeni from the State Law Advisors. And perhaps before we deal with this bill, I would want Mr. Makabeni to explain to us why the bill has not formally, this bill before us has not formally been tabled in Parliament.
Thank you, Chair. The bill was certified by our office on the 19th, and we forwarded it to LNP, Legislation and Proceedings Unit, for it to check for editing. And we were able to receive the proof on it on Friday. And LNP indicated they would only be able to discuss it with us yesterday. So we entirely dependent on the Legislation and Proceedings Unit for the editing and introduction of the bill. So they were only able to discuss it with us yesterday, and we had to request revised course because there were some changes, minor changes that the department also wanted to include in the bill as late as yesterday as well. So there's nothing that has changed in the content of the bill, but it has been to align it with the Principal Act and to effect typographical changes to the text. So it is a hiccup that will be resolved speedily with LNP.
Okay. So in other words, you take it upon yourselves that you will deal with the consequences that might arise out of this matter.
Chairperson, can I just ask, I mean, what is the haste with this, so that it cannot follow the correct procedure by that it must first be tabled? Why is it so essential that you bypass certain steps?
Look, it's not that it's not. What happened is that in terms of this Rule 159, the bill was tabled, But because it then went for certification, when during certification it had to come back and be tabled in its current form. So what we have here, and the committee had already scheduled this this session with the understanding that the bill has been tabled in Parliament. So, and the reason why we proceed today is because this is just the initial briefing. And if members feel that there are substantial changes in the bill that would warrant the bill to, you know, to stand off, that would be up to this committee. But that's why I was saying in closing, I take it that Mr. McAvaney says that the state law advisors would be held responsible for any consequences that might arise out of this. And she was just about to say yes. And, can we proceed in the, with the understanding that this is just the form, the initial briefing, because I take it that we are also going to be alerted to those minor changes and what the consequences of those changes are going to be with regard to people that have already commented on the bill, which may not necessarily, I mean some of the comments might be, you know, be talking to the issues that might have changed. And, that might put those people at a disadvantage. Mr. McCormick, I want you to raise your left hand. But first, let me take your hand, because...
Thank you, Chair. If I might just explain the technical corrections that CISA was referring to, basically between sort of certification of the bill and production of the first proof, the document gets retyped. And I think a lot of them related to that the underlining or bold was not correct. So it's very technical, I mean, it's not changing substance at all. And in terms of Rule 159, the bill that was tabled in terms of 159 and the final proof that were handed off today, you'll see there's no substantial changes. It's basically purely because the bill gets retouched when getting to the printer that certain technical or minor amendments need to be affected. And I think the delays and just trying to ensure that nothing is out of place. So there's no substantive change to any of the provisions of the bill.
Okay, we'll take your word for that. You are coming to come.
Yes.
I want you to say yes, you'll take full responsibility for any consequences that might arise.
Okay. I confirm what the chairman has just said to Chairperson and
and then, yes, you'll take full responsibility.
Yes, we will, Chair.
Mr. Fastenbeck. Go ahead.
Chair, if I can just explain quickly, I'm just purely a jockey today after a thorough race yesterday. So the main speakers from Fruityside today will be BIDDG, Ishmael Mamonian, and Catherine Gibson, who will lead us through most of the presentation. I think Mama will go first. Thanks.
Mr. Mamonian.
Thank you, Chair, and apologies for flooding you with this is the third bill in very short succession. That the FIC Amendment Bill, the Financial Laws, Financial Services General Laws Amendment Bill, and now the Insurance Amendment Bill. Chair, this bill is largely driven, this bill proposes amendments to the Long-Term Insurance Act and the Short-Term Insurance Act, both of which were passed, I think, in 1998. The approach we're going to take to this bill is just to outline the problem areas by and large and then outline our proposed amendment. We'll obviously give you the background and the alert you to the current provisions before we get to the problem. Chair, just in terms of, I think that there are only two substantive issues that we deal with in the bill. One is the demarcation between medical schemes and health insurance products, and secondly, some of the binder provisions, but let's come to that. In a moment. So just by way of background, and just to repeat, I guess, what I said, this bill proposes amendments to the two acts dealing with insurance, the long-term and short-term acts. The proposed amendments are required to update the legislation to close the regulatory gaps identified. So in this sense, they can't just be said to be technical. They tend to try and keep up with changes either in companies, act legislation on internal controls, or looking at practices in other parts of the world. And the primary objective is to strengthen, particularly in these turbulent times, the legislative framework for sound and well-regulated insurance industry to promote financial stability in the interest of both, firstly, of consumers and of industry players. I should add, Chair, and I'm hoping that, you know, I know that legislation itself doesn't mean that the industry will therefore be better regulated. I hope that you check that the changes that we have today will actually not just be implemented in full, but implemented in terms of the spirit that we want, that we do want a better regulated industry. I think that there are lots of issues there that need to be fixed up, but that's not dealt with in the legislation. It's dealt with, obviously, in the practice of how our regulatory agencies function. Just for the record, this bill has been gone through a pretty quick process, perhaps leading to some of the problems we have today with the tabling. It was submitted to Cabinet and approved by Cabinet at the end of April. It's in the process of being certified, as we've heard. It was published for public comment on the 9th of May, and it should be introduced in Parliament. Well, I don't know exactly when, Joanne may know, but this bill, once it's tabled, tomorrow.
No,
okay. Chair, just then to deal with the issues, I'm going to ask Cathy to in a moment just to come in on them, but just to get through to the significant proposed amendments, you'll see that there's a lot of common set of issues to both the Long-Term Insurance Act and the Short-Term Insurance Act. The two significant issues that we deal with is, if you look under the slide on the common amendment, it's the first bullet point, the demarcation between the health insurance and medical schemes business, and the last point, binder agreements. I would say that those are the more kind of new policy issues that need to be dealt with, or the more significant changes. They're not necessarily new policy, but some have been already the practice, particularly with binder agreements. But we also then try and modernize the arrangements around the auditor, expanding their functions and to align it, for example, with the Companies Act changes. We step up the role of the statutory actuary, including their reporting duties, and to ensure that they attend board meetings and are able to alert both the board and the registrar in the event of any problems. We update for the role of the audit committee, and then we look at the maintenance of financially sound conditions, just the, some of the capital adequacy arrangements that you have, particularly for the long-term insurance industry, it doesn't apply to the short-term industry. And we kind of look at a process for an independent review where the registrar identifies problems, and as I said, and we deal with the binder agreement. So those are the common set of issues that we deal with in both both acts. With regard to, and then in addition, with regard to long-term insurance, we deal with the whole process for awarding of bonuses to make sure that those don't bankrupt the company. And we also just deal with some related issues around assistance policy benefits like funerals and funeral cover and so on. We also then, with regard to the Short-Term Insurance Act, kind of lay the basis for the introduction of financial condition reporting, Cathy and Jonathan can deal with this, but it's to kind of again come in line with what we feel are better practices internationally. So we hope to. So I guess that could be said to be a significant matter that we want to raise today in the goal. Okay, just to move on, and before Kathy takes over and she should come in on this issue, I do want to alert you that you can press your button. That there is an issue of demarcation between health insurance and medical schemes. I think, Chair, just by way of background, obviously we try and ensure that we cover all insurance products between these two acts of Parliament. The only exception we make is for medical schemes. And, of course, it's very hard to draw the line between what's an insurance aspect on the one hand and what's a pure medical scheme. But certainly in between, there are lots of grey areas. And there are recent court cases that, for example, have come up, like the recent case of with Gardner, in terms of which the Council for Medical Schemes, for example, lost its case against Gardner. They tried to appeal it, but they've now been refused appeal as well to the Constitutional Court. But the whole issue revolves around all three acts of Parliament deal with these products in different ways and try and deal with different issues. Firstly, to get to the second bullet, the Council for Medical, the Medical Schemes Act deals with what it calls the business of a medical scheme, which tries to deal with your medical aid schemes and other similar schemes. The Long-Term Insurance Act deals with, I should add, it's not health policy. We're certainly not trying to take over health policy in the book. It's a health insurance policy. There's a lot of issues which are types of policy which are not necessarily medical schemes, but, for example, are triggered by health events. For example, if you get ill, there are policies which, for example, might compensate you for your loss of income. So the way we define health policy or health insurance policy is in terms of saying everything that's not a medical scheme, and then we have certain criteria, would be covered under those policies. And similarly, with the Short-Term Insurance Act, we have the accident and health policy, so that if you go overseas, you have travel and health cover. Those types of schemes are covered under these acts. Now, I think that this is an area that we've identified that we cannot really postpone, and given that the court case was pretty recent, that we need to decisively deal with what's covered by each of these definitions to try and avoid a future legal dispute. And I should add, to avoid undermining of health policy, because health, unlike your insurance policy, policies which are risk rated, you try and get a community rating for health so that if you're a certain age or you don't get discriminated against this because, for example, you're more prone to use health benefits. Now, this is an issue that certainly you will see on Friday in the hearings. The Council for Medical Schemes has raised an issue. The issue did go to Cabinet, and though initially issues were not raised, we're quite open to look at the issues because we agree that the issues are not so clear-cut. And I should add that we're certainly very committed to making sure that there isn't a shift away from medical schemes towards what they call gap cover insurance policies, for example. That would certainly undermine health policy. I think the only issue is how best to do it. The bill certainly, as it's published, suggests a way forward on how we would proceed with demarcating, just a process for demarcating, I should add. But to the extent that there have been other issues raised by the Department of Health, we've already had meetings with them about specific amendments that they would like to propose. We're still in the process of completing those discussions. We tried to have a meeting with the Council for Medical Schemes. That meeting could not take place because the Department of Health wasn't there, and we were very clear that we don't just want to meet with the regulators. We want to meet with the overseeing departments who are responsible for policy, because the regulators are not responsible for policy. So I think those are the set of issues, and I want to assure you that we are talking to them so that by the time we present our response to the committees, we'll hopefully have a joint view between us and the Department of Health and the two regulators. I don't know, Kathy, if you want to add on or anything on that matter you want to take over. Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to add in some more detail around the demarcation. I think the broad issues have been outlined quite clearly. The law has been identified that the definitions of health policy are contained in the Long-Term Insurance Act, the Accident and Health Policy and the Short-Term Insurance Act, and then the definition of business of a medical scheme and relevant health service are contained in the Medical Schemes Act. Confusion has arisen as to the interpretation of these definitions. More specifically, the subparagraphs 1, 2, and 3 of paragraph A and B, respectively, of the definition of health policy and accident health policy are currently joined by an and different interpretations exist whether exclusions set out in the subparagraphs are conjunctive or disjunctive. It was an interpretive issue which did lead to these legal disputes, as MoMA has been talking around. I suppose the nature of the question is what insurance product actually constitutes the business of a medical scheme. And as MoMA has indicated, the intention of our proposals here is not to be at this stage delineating between the various products. It's to be setting up the appropriate process and enabling a formal process to be set up whereby these policy decisions can be aligned between the Department of Finance and the Department of Health. The proposed amendment, therefore, is to empower the Minister of Finance, despite the definition of a business of a medical scheme, as contained in the Medical Schemes Act, after consultation with the Minister of Health, to make regulations which identify either a kind, a type, or a category of health policy. And it also looks to identify what the Minister must take into consideration in identifying those categories of products. So, for example, considering to ensure the sustainability of medical schemes and access to healthcare services, there are a number of other factors which must be taken into consideration as well. One of the other issues which had arisen was to provide for a dispute resolution process where, if it is uncertain whether a specific policy of a long-term or short-term insurer is part of one of these specific kinds of categories as has been described, and there is uncertainty around that, then there will be a process whereby the regulator can be both the regulators from both the FSB and the medical schemes will be able to determine that the specific policy is either a health insurance or a medical schemes policy. We can move on then, I think, looking to the role of the auditor. And in terms of the provisions, we're looking to expand the functions of the auditor and make sure that it is aligned with other legislation as well. Brief summary of the existing law, Section 19 of the Long-Term Insurance and Short-Term Insurance Act regulates the appointment of one or more auditors of the long-term and short-term insurer. It also regulates who may not be appointed as the auditor of the insurer, and as well as the reporting by the auditor to the registrar and the auditor's offices. The section refers to the Public Accountants and Auditors Act of 1991 and to certain applicable sections of that act. There have been a number of problems encountered and therefore motivated for the amendment. Firstly, the Auditing Profession Act has been repealed. The Auditing Professions Act has repealed the Public Accountants and Auditors Act. The main requirements for the appointment of an auditor of a long-term and short-term insurer must be aligned to requirements in the Companies Act to strengthen both corporate governance and apply these to insurers who are not incorporated under the Companies Act. The registrar also needs to be informed of problems at an insurer before that insurer becomes financially unsound or runs into other difficulties. and as the auditor is close to the financial affairs of the insurer and is well positioned to be flagging potential financial or risk management concerns. And then the auditor also needs to remain vigilant and cannot become complacent. And looking at taking into account some of these issues which need to be supported, the proposed amendments, first the technical amendments refer to the Auditing Professions Act. In addition to the name of the firm, the name of the individual registered auditor who undertakes the audit must be provided to the registrar. The same individual may not serve as the auditor or designated auditor of a long-term or short-term insurer for more than 5 consecutive financial years. And then there's where the individual has served for 2 or more consecutive years and then ceases to be an auditor or designated auditor, the individual may not be appointed again as the auditor or designated auditor until after an expiry of at least another 2 further financial years. The arrangements of who or may not be appointed as an auditor are aligned to Section 275(1) of the Companies Act. And importantly, the Long-Term Insurance Act and the Short-Term Insurance Act will now also require the auditor to inform the registrar without delay in writing of any matters relating to the business of the insurers that they become aware of in terms of performing the audit, which in their opinion might undermine the sustainability or the maintenance of a financially sound condition. And I think the key issue there is that what has been added in here is that the auditor must be is obliged to do this without delay, and that there has been an extension of their requirement to not only about the section 29.291 and 28.1 in the Short-Term Insurance Act, but that for any section of the Act which might undermine the maintenance of a financially sound condition. Moving on to statutory actuary, and here the statutory actuary has also had expanded reporting duties, and there have been new provisions added in for short-term insurers requiring a statutory actuary. Currently, the Long-Term Insurance Act does require that the statutory actuary reports to the board any matter that may prejudice an insurer's financial soundness. But it is not entitled or required to attend the meetings of the board. And currently, in terms of the Short-Term Insurance Act, no statutory actuary is prescribed to be appointed. Now, looking to what the concerns here is that given their position of being so closely aligned to the financial managings and business of the insurer, is that the statutory actuary could be in an important role important role in informing the registrar of problems at the insurer before it becomes financially unsound. In addition to which, it's also critical that the statutory actuary is adequately enabled to ensure that the concerns are dealt with at the board level. So the new Section 28C of the Long-Term Insurance Act will require that the statutory actuary attends board meetings of the long-term insurer and will be heard at those meetings on matters that can concern the duties of the statutory actuary. The statutory actuary would therefore be able to address the board on such matters and partake in the discussions. The proposed introductions of financial condition reporting, which we do get to at a later stage when talking about the short-term insurers, also will require them to appoint a statutory actuary under circumstances determined by the registrar. Lastly, the amendment of 63(4) of the Short-Term Insurance Act applicable to Lloyd's is consequential to the proposed addition of Section 19A. And then just looking to what the proposed amendments therefore require, they will extend the matters on which the actuary must report to the registrar. The requirements for this also impose requirements for the statutory actuary to attend and speak at board meetings. Look to the appointment and removal of the statutory actuary by a short-term insurer under circumstances defined by the registrar in terms of the Short-Term Insurance Act. To provide for the appointment and to provide for the removal of that statutory actuary. And looking now to the audit committee, and this is primarily to be aligning with other legislation. Currently, the long-term and short-term insurers must appoint an audit committee and determine the composition and duties of that audit committee. Just to be clear, the role of that audit committee is to be ensuring sound financial and risk management. Now, our current problems which have been experienced, given that the important role that the audit committee plays in the corporate governance of long-term and short-term insurers, certain sections need to be updated in line with the amendments to the Companies Act, and insurers which are not incorporated under the Companies Act must be required to comply with the Companies Act requirement for audit committees. What we propose then is that the relevant sections of the Long-Term Insurance Act will be amended based on the amendments to the relevant sections of the Companies Act as amended by the Corporate Laws Amendment Act in 2006. The composition of the audit committee will be in accordance with the provision of the Companies Act applicable to widely held companies, and the duties in the Long-Term Insurance and Short-Term Insurance Act will be complemented by the duties in Section 270 of the Companies Act. Through this arrangement, insurers which are not incorporated under the Companies Act will also be required to comply with the Company Act requirements for audit committees. Looking now to maintenance of a financially sound condition, the holding of assets and arrangements regarding liabilities. Section 29 of the Long-Term Insurance Act and Section 28 of the Short-Term Insurance Act regulate the maintenance of a financially sound condition of a financially sound condition of the long-term and short-term insurers, respectively. In other words, if an insurer does not comply with these sections, they will not be deemed to be to be maintaining a financially sound condition. Now, some of the issues that have been raised here is that insurers should value their assets on the basis of fair value determined in financial reporting standards, as introduced in the Companies Act. However, if the registrar is satisfied that the value of an asset, when calculated in accordance with financial reporting standards, does not reflect a proper value, the registrar may require that for spreading purposes. This power is similar to an existing power that the registrar has to adjust the value of assets. In addition, there is also currently a requirement that for the short-term Insurance Act for a contingency reserve, which will not be applicable under financial condition reporting. Now, the sections referred to in the deeming provision will include, in terms of the proposal, that a long-term and short-term insurer must provide for its liabilities and capital adequacy requirement. There is a prohibition on a long-term insurer to declare a dividend when it fails, or that would cause it to fail, to maintain a financially sound condition. And we're also looking to amend the kind and spread of assets regarding fair value and the capital adequacy requirement. Currently, the spread of assets is only required on the minimum capital adequacy, and it should in fact be on the calculated capital adequacy requirement for that insurer. We're also required to amend to require the long-term and short-term insurers to value their assets for spreading on fair value determined in financial reporting standards. And then lastly, to amend arrangements regarding liabilities of a short-term insurer by removing the obligation to hold a contingency reserve. Looking then to the independent review, this is a new provision. The Insurance Act provides that where the registrar is satisfied that a statement forming part of the returns furnished by an insurer requires further investigation, for the registrar to direct that insurer to furnish him or her with a report compiled by a person at his nomination. Now, the problems that have been encountered: the statutory returns that insurers submit to the registrar sometimes point to a matter that requires closer look. Such matter might be specialized and also needs to be dealt with speedily. a report by an expert on this matter would assist the registrar in assessing the statutory return and determine the correct risk rating for the insurer. An example would be to require a report from an actuary on the valuation of the liabilities and capital adequacy or aspects thereof for an insurer. Such a report may also assist the registrar to take action if it's required. So what is being proposed is that if the registrar is satisfied that a statement forming part of the returns furnished by either the long-term or short-term insurer requires further investigation, that the registrar may, by notice, direct the insurer to furnish him or her with a report, and that this report can be compiled by a person as nominated by the registrar. Moving on to binder agreements. This has been flagged already, and we appreciate that there are issues here which I think are going to need to be understood. Firstly, just to explain what a binder agreement is, it can be regarded as a payment or written statement making an agreement legally binding on the insurer or until the completion of a formal contract by an insurer takes place. It can be issued by either a company or an insurance intermediary and must contain certain information. So in other words, that the insurer is put on risk and is liable for a valid claim. Currently, the Long-Term Insurance Act does not provide provisions regarding binder agreements. In other words, these agreements are not regulated. The Short-Term Insurance Act does provide that an independent intermediary may render services in terms of a binder agreement entered into with a short-term insurer or Lloyd's underwriter, but it is quite limited in terms of that regulation. And so the wording of the provisions presents interpretation difficulties. Agreements between insurers and third parties are not always concluded in writing, and the functions that the third party may perform and the powers of the person to do so are not sufficiently clear. The third party may further delegate certain functions without the knowledge and permission of insurer. And of course, this then exposes the underlying policyholder to abuse. Certain of the services rendered as an intermediary and those rendered in terms of a binder agreement may be the same, and this results or can result in arbitrage across the commission regulation. There exist possible conflicts of interest when services as an independent intermediary and services in terms of a binder agreement are rendered by the same person. And, of course, there is the risk that the insurer may not actually accept liability for the actions of a third party in terms of the binder agreement. So what is being proposed is that Section 49A in the Long-Term Insurance Act be newly inserted, and likewise Section 48A in terms of the Long-Term Insurance Act. These sections will regulate the conclusion of an agreement in writing between the long-term and short-term insurer or Lloyd's underwriter and a person, and the agreement will set out the functions and powers of that person. These functions can look to, for example, the functions that this person can be performing is to enter into, vary or renew a long-term policy, a short-term policy, to determine the wording, to charge premiums, to determine the value of policy benefits, or to settle or pay claims. Now, it's not to say that the person who's entering into the agreement will be required to do all of these things, but they are just options that the insurer could be entering into. The section could also furthermore deal with the obligations of such persons to disclose the name of the insurer to policyholders. Yeah, so that just to make sure that there is a big disclosure component about who the insurer actually is, an obligation to be keeping and maintaining proper books of accounts of records and make sure that the insurer has access to those records as well. It prohibits a person to delegate, assign, or subcontract any of the functions from their own obligations and responsibility. There's limitations on the form of remuneration for services to avoid conflict and maintain transparency. The insurer may not authorize the person to do things such as to add on an amount to any gross premium or deducting the amount from any claim. And the person rendering services in terms of the binder agreement may also not be an independent intermediary for a particular type of policy contemplated in the agreement. And then last and foremost, perhaps, is that the accountability and responsibilities of both the long-term and the short-term insurer deals with that, the insurer will remain liable for the compliance of that. There were, just before we move on to the, sorry, you can move on to that slide, but before I move further on in terms of the specific amendments, just to draw attention to three other areas that we can speak to more if required, and this is to the assignment of the powers to Deputy Registrar, which in effect is just in a it's just in alignment with other legislation. There's extending the powers of the registrar regarding conditions of registration being subject to the, an insurer maintaining a financially sound position. And then also various other, there's consequential amendments which have been made. So if there are queries around these specific more technical amendments, to please, we obviously will answer those in due course. Looking then to proposed amendments specific to the Long-Term Insurance Act, or the more significant proposals, looking to the award of a bonus or similar benefit. Currently, the Long-Term Insurance Act provides that a long-term insurer shall not award a bonus or similar benefit to a policyholder unless the statutory act is satisfied. What the law is proposing is that you cannot, in fact, award a bonus unless your statutory actuary is satisfied that it's actuary is sound and that a surplus is available for that purpose. What has been happening is that long-term insurers award certain bonuses under long-term policies in their discretion, and the bonuses do not vest immediately. And that this effectively means that the insurer may reduce the bonus in its discretion until such time as it then vests. The decision to award bonuses or to remove all or part of non-vested bonuses must be done in a proper and transparent manner, and this is currently not necessarily the case. And so when market conditions deteriorate or when financial condition of an insurer deteriorates, the insurer may decide to remove all or part of non-vested bonuses. And this action obviously impacts policyholders and needs to be done in a proper and transparent manner. So what is proposed is to further regulate the award of the bonus as described, to ensure fair and equitable treatment of policyholders eligible for bonuses or awards. The Long-Term Insurance Act will require that the long-term insurer has in place principles and practices of financial management for the purposes of awarding these bonuses. And this effectively means that the so-called approved principles and practices must be approved by the board of directors of the long-term insurer and sets out the nature of the discretion retained. Looking to assistance policy benefits, currently in terms of the Long-Term Insurance Act, there is provision that a party to an assistance policy can request a non-monetary benefit. However, there have been problems that funeral services, when it comes to claiming on an assistance policy, funeral services are provided only within a certain geographical area. So when the policyholder locates outside of that area, in order not to forfeit the funeral benefit, they may then request a sum of money, and that could be a substantially lower amount than what will be expected the funeral to cost. What is going to be preferable is that the policyholder should know up front what the monetary equivalent of the non-monetary benefit will be. In addition to which, a cross-reference to the definition of assistance policy will also ensure that the non-monetary benefit under an assistance policy does not exceed the maximum amount in terms of that definition. So a new dispensation is proposed to be introduced for assistance policies. The terms of such a policy providing a non-monetary benefit will have to include terms that will express the non-monetary benefit as a sum of money and allow a person to request the non-monetary benefit as that sum of money. The insurer must provide the stated sum of money in lieu of the non-monetary benefit if the person so requests. Proposed amendments that are specific to the Short-Term Insurance Act. we are now moving to the end of the presentation. I think what has to be, the most important thing to be understood here is that we are moving to a system of risk-based supervision, and these amendments as we are proposing here are not the final dictate of how that new supervision will take place. What it does do, however, is enable the regulations after the process has gone through to be set in place and to be providing for the introduction of what we are referring to as financial condition reporting. Schedule 2, currently of the Short-Term Insurance Act, regulates the method of calculation of the value of assets and liabilities. The liabilities consist of various reserves to cover possible future risks. The current measure of solvency based on a fixed percentage of net written premium, however, does not take into account either the size of the insurer or the inherent risks underlying the types of business that it writes. So the proposed amendments, as indicated, they're enabling provisions for the planned future introduction of financial condition reporting to amend and adjust the Schedule 2 regarding the method of calculating the value of assets and liabilities, to incorporate all the requirements which are necessary to introduce financial condition reporting, which will be done in due course. What financial condition reporting does is it introduces a risk-based approach to solvency calculation. It's being developed in consultation with industry based on international developments adjusted for South African circumstances. Both the value of the liabilities and the capital adequacy requirement can be calculated using either a prescribed rules-based method or by developing an internal model or certified model. And this is along the lines as adopted by Basel II for banks. And consequential amendments are necessary to Schedule 3 to enable the possible future introduction of financial conditional reporting to cover Lloyd's underwriters. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. There we have it. It's, again, another omnibus, but just that it travels between long-term and short-term. Members,
short questions. On financial stability, can perhaps the presenter explain how can the insurance, say short-term or long-term insurance company, cause financial instability? I just imagine where 30% of the people make claims, and then how will it affect it, or perhaps the pay bonuses to officials, how will it affect financial stability? Or is perhaps the capital requirement, adequate capital requirement, how is it affected? And then another question here is on the bonuses to insurance to officials. I don't know if I just want to find out whether it's not interference in the industry when you say they cannot have bonuses or you keep bonuses. I'm just trying to equate or to compare it to our state-owned enterprises, SOEs. For instance, ESCOM, where we say there's a contractual agreement that we must pay them for that, even though we think that they are not performing. Perhaps I'm just comparing apples and oranges.
Yeah. So for the bonuses referred to here are bonuses to policyholders. Bonuses to policyholders. That they're not allowed to declare them because they would declare them, but they are not paid out. They declare them even if they're not going
to pay.
Yeah. To policyholders. Yeah. Okay. Was that the lot?
No. Yeah, that was the lot. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Mr. And then Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make reference here to clause number 11, where you are basically restricting the payment of a declaration or payment of the dividend to shareholders. And under number C, it sets out a clear requirement. It says, if after such declaration or payment, the aggregate value of its assets required by Section 30 would be less than the aggregate value of its liabilities, issued share capital, and non-distributable reserve. I just want to know how you actually decided that this would be the hurdle. And then on the bonuses, the vested bonuses, if I understood correctly, there was reference to the reduction in the vested bonus for policyholders. In 1998, when the market corrected itself, there was a distinct difference between vested bonuses and non-vested bonuses. What the insurance company did was that the non-vested bonuses obviously fell away, and then what they did was took current vested bonus to zero, and that was how they seem to have organized it. So if you're talking about removing a vested bonus, I hope I misunderstand that. And then, just as an observation, Chair, this is very complex legislation. You know, as you mentioned, it's an omnibus, and I think, you know, as we go through and some of the stuff we only really got today, you know, I just wonder whether we as a committee are actually able to wrap our minds around all of these concepts in a suitable manner. Just an observation or concern. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, we'll deal with that part at the end of the process. But just remind me that we deal with it. Okay. The other one was...
Thank you, Chair. Just to the presenters, you know, there's going to be an obligation on short-term insurers now to appoint actuaries. Now, by their very nature, actuaries are very conservative people, and they will see a tsunami around every corner. So, you know, has any study been done with regard to the actual effect this will have on the premiums paid by policyholders, you know, for short-term insurance? Because surely it should have an effect. It will probably have an effect on the price that we have to pay for the more conservative approach. I accept that there should be protection of the consumer, but I just wonder whether there's been any studies with regard to the effect thereof.
Thanks, Chairperson. Good morning. I just want to check, what would be the effects of this legislation on insurances that are not, run by formal insurance companies? For instance, you have companies that are general dealers. They will sell airtime and then also sell insurance products within them. What would be the effect of this legislation on them? Because I think to a certain point, your legislation seems not to be capturing them. And then the second question would be, Mr. Swart, Honorable Swart did capture it, the one on actuaries. I want to check, why do you want to leave the discretion of appointing and removing actuaries to the registrar? Thank you.
Just a small question. You've pointed out that, and given the reasons why you want the short-term insurance industry to move away from contingency reserves to FCRs. I just want to establish whether there are any transitional mechanisms that you are putting in place for that transition. How is that transition going to occur? Is it something that is going to occur overnight as the bill is being passed? Or there's a bit of an arrangement to ensure that there's a smooth transition on that matter?
Sorry, thank you, Chair. Just three questions. One is on the assistance policy benefits. and tightening up of systems policy. Now, what happens, you refer here to funeral policies, but there are also what is called funeral schemes. Now, I don't know if there's, you know, you can distinguish between funeral schemes and funeral policies, where funeral service directors, charge families 10 rand a month or 20 rand a month, and if somebody dies within the family, then they come there and provide a service. Now, from my own experience, this is open to a lot of abuse, because people get tied into a particular coffin and a particular grave, and then you become a victim of circumstances. Now, in certain communities, funerals take place within 24 hours or 36 or 48 hours at the most. Now, are these funeral plans also going to be covered here, or is it just the sophisticated, formal funeral benefit covers that we know about? But what I'm pleased about even on this is the amendment to say that there should be a monetary benefit, so that you're not obliged to use a particular funeral service. Because I had a case where a family came to me, they wanted to use another funeral service provider, but the person who sold them the policy was the funeral services director. And you feel kind of obligated to use that person, although the law states that you're not obligated to. So can we just have some clearing up so that our ordinary poor people have clarity on the ground about funeral policies, funeral schemes, and how we tighten this up. The second one is on your clause 23, because you speak about definitions being a bit of a problem. And now the business of a medical scheme, you want to redefine that. But I see it's the Minister of Finance after consultation with the Minister of Health. Now, in the opening statements, we were told that there's a lot of consultation with the Ministry of Health, and rightly so. Shouldn't that be in consultation and not after consultation, so that you get your definitions of medical schemes and all that sorted out? And the last one is just to follow Mr. Swat and Ms. McCulture, is the question of actuaries versus assessors. Because every short-term insurance company, at the moment, they have assessors. Now, what is wrong with them continuing to have assessors to assess damage, damages and things like that? Thank you.
Let's take responses.
Thank you, Chair. I was getting worried when things said from personal experience. I'm sure it's other people's experience around the field, though not his own. I think just to, we're going to spread just the answering of these responses. The department will deal with the policy issues. We'll leave it to the FSB to deal with the technical questions. I think most of them were technical questions. Let me just deal with the two policy issues, which is the in consultation and after consultation issue, and the funeral cover, which Kathy can comment on. I think just on the demarcation of health products, bear in mind we are looking at the process, but I think we take the point that is the gist of the discussion that we are having with the department. We haven't completed those discussions, but I think that's where we're probably going to get to, that it will be in consultation. But we're still, you know, trying to get consensus, but I think we're getting there. But perhaps on the funeral covers, do you want to?
If I could please clarify, are you meaning the informal funeral provision? Burial scheme? These provisions do not include that, do not include the burial schemes, as I understand it. Just to bring your the Honourable Member's attention to a broader process which is taking place around abuses which have been taking place in the funeral insurance business. And we are looking to an overhaul of the entire space to ensure better consumer protection and provision of what has been extended to, in fact, be considering microinsurance. So that even though these provisions don't explicitly accommodate your concerns, that these are being accommodated in another process.
But
the there has been released a discussion paper on the future of microinsurance in South Africa that was released in earlier this year, and it's looking to provide a regulatory housing of providers, both the currently there's many illegal operators in this space, and provide a greater protection mechanism for consumers of these products in that space.
Yes, Chair, we can give you copies of the paper, but let me say, and we're just dealing with the policy issues first. That's why we started with your questions. I think those are some of the policy issues. Chair, I should say that there's a whole range of issues on the market conduct issues and consumer protection issues, which certainly I think in this industry is a big issue and something that the bill doesn't deal with, but certainly it's an area that through those the paper that we've released, it's just one mechanism to deal with it. And specifically, the whole issue of funerals is a sensitive one, and I think something that we would welcome comments around the paper that we've produced, and then to see whether the nitty-gritty will actually work out like the way we intend. I don't know if there's any other policy issues, Bernard or Joanne, you want to comment on before we hand over to FSC.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think just a general comment up front, and it links to the first question about how can insurance companies affect financial stability. I think the general comment is that most of the proposed amendments in the bill actually deal with the issues of how to make regulation of the insurance industry more effective. So there's the proposals on the audit committee and the statutory actuary and the auditor are all designed to, if you like, bolster the regulator's job of properly supervising insurance companies, because often they are the first line of defense, if you like, that help the regulator do their job properly. And why do we have such a focus on proper supervision of insurance companies is because in a very similar way to banks, they can present a major problem for overall financial stability if they get into a financially unsound situation. And that's because a lot of insurance business is about taking premiums today in return for a promise to pay somebody out at some point in the future if a specific event takes place. Now, and that's very similar to a bank, which takes your money today and promises to pay it out when you want your money out again. And that's the fundamental regulatory challenge. You've taken somebody's money today in return for a promise of a future benefit. And then, obviously, the regulator's job is to make sure that the insurance company remains in a position where it's financially sound enough to be able to meet its future promises. And that's, in a nutshell, the whole underlying principle of insurance regulation. So how can insurance companies affect financial stability? If insurance companies start to get into financial difficulties where the money they're paying out is less than the money they're getting in from premiums, and their liabilities to policyholders starts to be greater than their assets, that basically means they're in a position not to be able to meet their promises. So people who've paid premiums for a number of years, expecting that when they die, their dependents will get money from their life policy, for instance. Obviously, if the insurance company can't do that, then it means that people in society are really could be left potentially destitute if the insurance company fails. So that's the I suppose, if you like, the possible impact on individuals. as soon as you start to have a largish insurance company, you can't meet its promises. That then potentially has a spillover effect into the entire financial sector. So that's why that focus on financial stability. I just wanted to touch on the question of bonuses as well. And as we've clarified, it's bonuses paid to policyholders. And that relates to what is termed with-profit business. That tends to be some of the older style insurance policies that were written, which said, okay, we will guarantee you a certain return on your savings, on your investment policy. We'll give you a guaranteed return, but if the market performs better than that return, we may give you a bonus. We may pay the policyholder a bonus if the market outperforms. Now, we're not actually introducing anything really new here in the proposed amendment. All we're doing is addressing the problem that process of deciding what the bonus should be was often done in quite a non-transparent way in the past. And a lot of some of the insurance company problems that you've seen or consumer complaints have related to the fact that they don't know on what basis does the insurance company decide to pay a bonus or not. So it introduces what is an internationally accepted principle called principles of PPFM, principles and practices of financial management. So it's an international standard. We're bringing up to international standards. And all it says is this process of deciding on the bonus must be done in a particular way and a very transparent way. So that's the main thing. It relates to the question around vested versus non-vested bonuses. Again, just to clarify, we're not introducing anything new here. Because currently how it works is that if an insurance company finds that they're not getting very good returns on their assets and start to struggle to meet their guarantees, their first line of defense is to sometimes retract what are called the non-vested bonuses, which are bonuses which were kind of indicated, that the company indicated they would give a bonus, but they haven't actually vested it. Now, currently, the legislation does provide that they can claw that back if they get into trouble. Mostly insurance companies try not to do that because it is seen as it obviously doesn't make customers very happy when that happens. So most companies try and prevent that and try to use their shareholder funds as a buffer to make sure that they meet their bonuses, but there is provision that they can take back non-vested bonuses. If the insurance company still remains in trouble, they are legally entitled to also claw back some of the vested bonuses, but that happens in very extreme cases. I think it's very rare, maybe once in the last decade, and that was the Fedshaw case, which, as we know, was basically an insurance failure. Obviously, it's a last resort, but it is legally possible. So we're not changing any of that. All we're saying is that all those decisions need to be done in a very transparent manner. And similarly, the same applies to the question about restricting payment of dividends. Currently, insurance companies, there was a question of how did we arrive at the standard of being liabilities plus non-distributable reserves. That has always been the standard. That is seen as the solvency standard, if you like, for the insurance company. So it's their liabilities plus a buffer to provide, to make sure the insurance company stays sound. So there's no new standard. All that the amendment is saying is that before the company pays a dividend, the statutory actuary must sign off that by paying the dividend, the company doesn't caused itself to dip below the standard. So it's something that would be common sense you would expect anyway, because the companies are supposed to meet the standard, but it's just making explicit that there must be prior sign-off before the dividend is paid. So I guess the general statement is, whilst it may appear that there are some complicated technical amendments, most of them are really about not introducing new things, but perhaps closing some potential gaps here and there. Now, there was a question about the obligation on the short-term insurance company to appoint actuaries. I think the first point is that not all short-term insurance companies will have to appoint actuaries. It's only in specific circumstances as required by the registrar. And what that relates to is this is forward-looking again. So this is not something that would come into effect necessarily now. This is forward-looking to the potential introduction of financial condition reporting. And what SCR will do is that it will allow short-term insurance companies to actually use internal models to calculate their risk exposures and the capital that they need to hold against those risk exposures. So if a short-term insurance company chooses to go that route and follow an internal model of calculating risk instead of using the prescribed model, then that means they're now in a different level of what they need to do in terms of calculating risk and so on, and that will require actuarial skills, but that's only in the cases where they choose to take that route. The other important thing I think that needs to be, and there was a question also about SCR and transitional mechanisms. I think maybe the one thing that didn't come out clearly from the presentation is that we're not the amendments don't ask for the approval of an approach to SCR at this point. All they're really saying is that they want to put in place enabling provisions that will enable the future implementation of SCR probably in 2 to 3 years' time from now, after what I'm sure will be a very thorough process of consultation with the industry, and I think those issues should come back to this committee as well. Very much in the same way that we came to this, that the Treasury came to this committee last year with the Banks Amendment bill to introduce Basel II for banks. SCR is essentially Basel II for short-term insurance companies. It introduces risk-sensitive approaches to measuring the risk, the capital that a short-term insurer will need to hold against their risks. And what happened in the case of Basel II is that there was about a 2 to 3 year process with the banking sector to go through the types of measures that would need to be put in place to implement Basel II, and an intense process of writing, formulating regulations and so on. So what is envisaged is a similar process for short-term insurers, so probably a 2 to 3 year process from now to debate these issues and debate what the final SCR requirements would look like. And I've lost my place now, but the other thing was the potential impact of SCR. And what the National Treasury did with the Basel II was that they conducted an impact study, a study into the economic impact of introducing Basel II. And certainly from the FSB side, what we would like to propose we do jointly with the National Treasury is an economic impact study on the introduction of FCR. So before we come back to this committee with any final proposals on what FCR would look like, we would like to do that impact study. So at this point, the proposed amendments are just really about putting in enabling provisions to allow for that kind of process. The appointment and removal of the statutory actuary at the discretion of the registrar, that's already a requirement that's in the Long-Term Insurance Act. So all we're doing is saying that for the short-term insurers, if it comes to the point where they need a statutory actuary, we want to have alignment that the registrar may also have to approve or may remove a statutory actuary. And that's because, and why that provision is there is that because the statutory actuary actually plays a very important role in the overall regulatory framework. They're in many ways the first line of defense. They are meant to pick up potential financial problems in the insurance company. So the registrar needs to have some confidence that the person who's doing that is actually properly qualified and is fit and proper. Now,
Mr. Johnson, in that it's the company that appoints.
Yes.
You just check the fit and proper.
Yeah.
And if they fail to appoint, only then the registrar will come.
Yeah, that's right. And then I think there was a question around informal insurers. And the question, there was a question around shop owners who may be selling insurance products. Now, we'd have to distinguish between whether that shop owner was acting in the capacity as an intermediary or a broker, if you like, or whether the shop owner was acting in the capacity of in an underwriting capacity. There's plenty of examples where a person will be acting as an intermediary for an insurance company. In other words, they sell the insurance company, but the obligation to pay out any claims doesn't lie with the shop owner. It lies with the insurance company that issues the policy. In which case, that shop owner would fall under the requirements of the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, the FICE Act that deals with brokers and intermediaries. So they would be regulated there. We have seen problems, and this is specifically with funeral directors, where they're selling the insurance product, so they're acting as an intermediary, but they're not always paying over the premium to the insurance company. So actually what's happening is they are self-underwriting, in a sense. They are taking on the job of the insurance company as well. So they're keeping the premiums, and if there's a claim, they pay it out of their own money. But then the problem is they escape the whole solvency requirements that we put in place for insurance companies to make sure they can meet their promises. So that is an unregistered insurance business that they're doing, and that is illegal. And we have a process from the FSB to make sure that we're clamping down on illegal insurance business. But I also wanted to touch on the issues of the burial scheme. Now, what distinguishes a burial scheme from an assistance policy is that burial schemes are really done on an informal basis. They often arise out as a group of, a grouping in a community, and it's quite different in nature, and it's really done on the basis of trust amongst members of the grouping. It's similar to a stock sale arrangement where, and in fact, it's not actually insurance business, because what it really is a group savings arrangement. People contribute money every month, and then the expectation is that if somebody within the grouping dies, or a relative of somebody in the grouping dies, then that pot of savings is used to cover the funeral expenses. So it's but there is no formal promise. There is an expectation that those savings will be used to meet the funeral costs, but there's no formal promise that you would find in a formal insurance arrangement. Now the challenge is that most of those work okay when it's a smallish group of people and everybody knows each other and there's trust. Obviously, there'll always be a case where there might be a rotten apple in the group. People thought they could trust somebody, but then they subsequently can't. But that's, I think, that's a problem with those kind of trust-based arrangements that you're never going to be able to get around through regulation. So more of the problem comes when those group arrangements based on trust start to get bigger and bigger, and the members don't know each other, and there's more potential for bad apples to come into the group. Now, what the microinsurance paper that Cathy has been talking about includes is a way for those kind of larger burial schemes to migrate, to evolve into more formal insurance arrangements. So there is a policy process around that in the microinsurance paper. And it also would allow for some of these funeral directors who may be tempted to do unregistered insurance business to also migrate to a more formal arrangement. So part of the challenge is to enable more accessible formal arrangements that people can take use of, rather than having to rely on these informal arrangements. And then the last one is just on the actuaries versus the assessors. Just to point out, the short-term insurers will continue to have assessors to assess the risk, assess the damage in particular cases, but the job of the actuary is slightly different in terms of projecting possible claim scenarios and so on, doing projections.
Maybe let's conclude this now that we have taken this briefing. But the point that Dr. George raised with regards to the complexity and I would imagine also at parliament level, since the executive level and at official level, you are talking to the Department of Health. I think it would also be proper for ourselves also to engage with the portfolio committee on health, so that the process gets also, denied. Because I see that the case that you are referring to, the grant risk case, the Council for Medical Schemes just lost it a few days ago, was it the 19th or something of May. So it's a matter that is left to need our careful consideration in order for us to be able to move. You were just talking about one part of it, but also you're touching on both now the long-term and the short-term insurance. I see some of the matters relate to the intermediary remuneration, and I believe there's a paper also, the statement of intent that has been signed with the industry and all sorts of things. But we will proceed to hearings and hear the other views, and then we will decide at the committee whether we proceed. You will realize there are some urgent matters that need to be dealt with, but some of them might actually require some careful consideration before we take a decision. Thank you. That brings us to the close of this one. We'll break for 10 minutes and then come back and. I see my colleagues from the Budget Committee on Finance and the Budget Committee are itching to get onto the real matter that brought us together here today. But it was it was interesting to have you around on the insurance amendment bill as well. Thank you. 10 minutes, and then we'll come back here at exactly quarter past.
I'm going to electrocute myself and fix it. My adapter, thanks.
One, the other one, you pay 5,000 more.
Cardboard coffers.
Yeah?
Cardboard coffers.
So our
they
people are really being, you know, and it's 5 rand a month or 10 rand a month or something, but.
It's 5 rand a month
because you're on the education of the children. Yeah. Yeah. Really, so I'm going to ask this point to write something for me. So I can inform people. You must be very careful about things and policies and schemes.
But I think they also need for not to what
correct. I wrote this information examination.
You know, like don't have your funeral,
or
you're not obliged to use this funeral,
yeah,
or you are not obliged to have flowers and fancy coffins and. And also, how do you try to deal with the reporting of an estate? There's something else about me.
I raised that. I was invited to open a new crematorium facility. Brand new, lovely facility.
Yeah.
In fact, I opened a new graveyard, a new memorial park.
You get your stuff to do, don't you?
The premier said he was going to open this new memorial park.
Yeah.
Then the next time I was invited on my own to open up this new facility. And I spoke to them about the high cost of funeral and how it gets exploited, particularly among people. You know, they wear designer clothes to funerals. And if they don't spend a hell of a lot of money on a funeral, they feel that the spirit will, you know, okay, that if you got the money, we do it. But there are others who...
They have to.
And I raise it quite strongly.
And they cripple themselves. Yeah.
And I raise the difference between cremation and burial.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, there are some religious groups that don't allow cremation.
And some that insist upon it. Yeah.
But those that also allow cremation, I find they're daring. And we're going to run short of space. And I said this 7 years ago. And we have run short of space. So I said maybe there needs to be a debate among all the religious leaders about, you know, one or the other without pushing it down anybody's throat. So it started a whole big thing in Israel.
There is a burial space at the Jewish cemetery in Prague.
Yeah.
Where the graves are collected.
Yeah.
And they're buried sort of 18.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Of course, that information not to be permitted.
Yeah.
Quite bizarre.
Dr. George's girl child that he brought to work today, Rihanna, at the back there. And,
Rihanna.
Dr. George, you are the only one that took this campaign seriously. I see none of the other members did that. Welcome, Rihanna. It's good to have you here. At least you will be able to tell people that parliamentarians don't do what people think they do. Because following Dr. George through the day, you will see how busy an MP's day is. Well, we also welcome the two committees that we are with here today, the Joint Budget Committee and the Select Committee on Finance have joined us on this Financial Management of Parliament Bill. The request we had sent was that the bill be cleaned up because of those cross-references to the PFMA. And we are back here now with Advocate Jenkins, who is just going to quickly take us through some of those changes that reflect that has been done. And then, as the committee is aware that we have received indication that National Treasury would like to make a submission on the bill, and we are then on Friday going to take National Treasury. I had thought that we would be able to take them today as well, but it didn't work out. We are then going to take National Treasury's submission on Friday, and then the committee would have to apply its mind how we take the process forward. It seems like the committee is overwhelmed with a lot of this, this technical stuff that seems to come all at the same time. But unfortunately, some of us have to do the work. So, yeah, Advocate Jenkins, can I hand over to you just to take us through quickly those sections?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, good morning, colleagues, media, members of the public. I don't have a slide presentation, unless I must put the bill up. But if members no, I have it on my flash disk, but it's without pictures and it's just a bill. So if it's good for you, Chair, then I'll just take the copy that was distributed. Yes. Okay. No, fine. There's a question.
Whilst they're still setting up, can I just make a small announcement? I've just received the news that CPI for April is 11.1%, up from 10.6% in March. CPI X up for April 10.4%, up from 10.1% in March. So, yeah, you know what to expect. I don't think there's much you can do at this point.
And Chair, GDP is down. This thing doesn't sell very nicely.
Okay. Advocate Jenkins, are you? Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Member. I will skip the content and so on of the books. Those are just consequential. The First Amendment I effected was in the interpretation and objects section, or clause one, I should say, the definition of annual national budget. I won't say that this is important or substantial
amendment. It's merely just to remove the textual reference to the PFMA. So I've just made a different definition. Instead of referring to the Public Finance Management Act, we just refer to the annual national budget that's tabled by the Minister of Finance in the National Assembly. I think it comes down to the same thing. The next amendment would be clause 16. That's on page 16 as well. That is a substantive amendment or substantial amendment. It's about the annual budget, and it says that the budget is 10 months prior to the start of the financial year. The accounting officer must prepare a draft budget for Parliament and present it to the executive authority. And then at 16.2H, it says it must be in accordance with a format prescribed by the section 76 read with section 27.3 of the PFMA. Now that has the effect, of course, of forcing Parliament to comply with the format prescribed by the Treasury, by the Executive, in other words, which is the issue of separation of powers. What it should be, and in fact the present PFMA actually spells it out like that, that regulatory function is a function of Parliament's creation, namely the Speaker and the Chairperson acting jointly. Now in fact the present PFMA spells it out like that. It says in I think it's section 3 or 5 that any regulatory function performed by the Treasury must be performed by the Speaker and the Chairperson acting jointly. So I'm just trying to put that in there by just referring rather to the executive authority rather than a cross-reference to the national, to the PFMA.
What section in the PFMA did you say that is?
I think it's section...
Where it says that those
section 3.2. Section 3.2 of the PFMA says that to the extent that the provision of this Act applies to Parliament, any controlling and supervisory functions of the National Treasury in terms of that provision are performed by the Speaker and the Chairperson acting jointly.
Okay. Can we... I just wanted us to note it, and then we will go back to each amendment. Can members just flag that, and then we will discuss it? So as to allow him to touch on those that we need to talk to. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. The next amendment is clause 17, submission of drafts of strategic plan, annual performance plan, and budget. When one looks at clause 2 there, it says that the executive authority must, in consultation with the minister, determine a process for submitting Parliament's budget. So that means there must be an agreement between Parliament and the Minister of Finance, and sort of shared responsibility then. Now, if we're going from the constitutional position that Parliament's Treasury is in charge of Parliament's financial management as the executive authority, then I think the best, the next best after in consultation would be after consultation, meaning that the full decision-making powers will lie with Parliament's Treasury, but it will have to speak to the Minister of Finance before it makes those regulatory decisions. Similar amendment is done to clause 17.2c. There we must submit the budget and adjustment of budgets to the National Treasury by a date agreed with the Minister of Finance. That once again creates a situation where Parliament is dependent upon the decision of the executive, and I suggest that that be removed.
one would now ask, by what date should we then submit these? If the Minister of Finance is not going to tell us when to submit it by. Now, I thought that 2A actually covers that, Honourable Chair. Because there will be a consultation process between National Treasury and Parliament's Executive Authority to determine a process for submitting Parliament's budget and adjustment. And I thought that process includes the date by when. Yes, 2A would actually cover C. But it also makes the point that the Parliament, in any case, will take the final decision on that. I just want to say, in case it sounds like we're pushing for a position where Parliament will have complete reign over its own thing, there's no system here for the political players behind the financial management here. In other words, if National Treasury, in consultation or during the consultation process, informs the Executive Authority of Parliament that these are the timelines by which budgets, adjustment budgets should be brought to them for consideration, and that if it's brought after that date, it will be very difficult to accommodate Parliament at that point. I compare that very similar to when Parliament says to the Executive, by this date, bring us your legislation, otherwise it will be very difficult for us to pass that legislation. So you sort of politically put in a position where you say, fine, if you want what we want in our adjustment budget, we will bring it to you by that date. But you're not going to prescribe in legislation that it must be by that date. It's in our interest that we comply with your time frames as well, and that is consultation, in my opinion. The next amendment, Honourable Chair, it's the same consultation issue, clause 29. Provision there is the requisitioning of funds by the accounting officer, which read that the Executive Authority must, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine a process for requisitioning appropriated funds that provide for sound cash flow management. Now, I'm just suggesting that we go rather the route of after consultation. Honourable Chair, the next amendment is clause 40. It's about the supply chain management policy.
I just wondered if we've covered the third point made on page 17, referring to clause 18, 2A.
No, we haven't dealt with it.
Go back to this.
Thank you. If I can take. Thank you very much. The proposed amendment in clause 18.2 is more textual than anything other. It reads any revision of an appropriation in terms of subsection 1A must be made by a national adjustment budget. So that's just your adjustment budget. And then I suggest that we remove refer to in section 30 of the Public Finance Management Act. Textually, let's remove that. I mean, when we're saying by a national adjustment budget, much like the national budget, it should be, in my opinion, it's reasonably clear, or clear enough at least to understand what it is, rather than referring to the PFMA. So it stands with that. It's about the supply chain management.
On page 22, is there one that is put again? I think it's chapter 4. The requisition of one. You did it.
Yeah, we did it. Okay.
Yeah.
The unfortunate part is when he was dealing with it, some of us were concentrating on what he skipped. So we couldn't concentrate on what he was saying.
Yeah, that's the problem.
clause 29, requisitioning of funds by the accounting officer. Provision at the moment is that the executive authority must, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine a process for requisitioning of funds that has been appropriated, in other words. Once again, the decision-making power there is shared. There must be agreement reached to bring that provision in effect. And if one proceeds from the constitutional position that Parliament is in control of its internal proceedings and procedures, including its budget processes, then I would suggest the best one can do is say after consultation. Once again, the best as an option rather than in consultation. After consultation, one can also remove it completely and leave the whole issue of consultation as a political process. But I have actually a view on that, which I'll share at the end of this presentation, if I may. Okay, that was now clause 29, which brings us now to clause 40. The amendment there is that 40 sub F, it's just a reference to the supply chain management framework issued in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. Now, that once again takes the control to the executive, to the Treasury. My suggestion is we just remove it in total, because the executive authority must prescribe, in any case, a supply chain management policy. To open it to a possible challenge that it might be consistent or might not be consistent to the supply chain management policy referred to in the PFMA, in fact limits the authority of Parliament to control its internal proceedings, and it limits it on the side of the executive. Not limits in terms of what Parliament prescribes for itself. Because the supply chain management issues in the PFMA is partly covered, well, to a very small extent covered in the PFMA as I read it, and to a large extent covered in the regulations. And the regulations do not get approved by Parliament. So, from that angle, I have a constitutional issue once again with the separation of powers. Perhaps, Chair, if I just stall here and say what I've just referred to. You know, when we're looking at this FOP level compared to the PFMA at the moment, not the proposed amendment, one sees that when one works with Parliament, there's a lot more detail in the legislation. Now, the philosophy behind that is to say Parliament is going to be its own treasury, but it's going to be bound by legislative provisions, but it still remains its own treasury. The PFMA system creates the treasury there, of course, and then says that treasury can provide in regulation for issues like supply chain management and so on. So whereas Parliament must exhibit, or the legislation of Parliament exhibit a certain type of discipline, to say we're not going to have everything in your regulations, we're going to have more detail in the Act. So it's going to be more transparent and more open. And less detail in the regulations. Just to put that out there, because that's a very important point when one comes to questions about how much detail must be captured in the legislation. The next amendment would be page 32, clause 47. That's the Audit Committee. 47.5. It's once again that the, this is a classic example. The issue of the Audit Committee is determined in the regulations, partly in the regulations or to the PFMA. So there one wants to say no. That takes, once again, the authority away from Parliament's Treasury. And I propose that that be deleted, and rather to say the executive authority must determine the terms of appointment and remuneration of members of the Audit Committee, rather than the Minister of Finance determining those through the regulations to the PFMA. If I can take the committee to court 50. I might just repeat what I've just said. The same thing we now with the internal audit unit. Now, the PFMA just requires that the accounting officer establishes an internal audit system, a system of internal audit, I think it's called. And the rest is then captured within your treasury regulations. Two steps of proposal. One, in any case, their Parliament's internal audit unit is now provided for in detail in this bill. But on its own is a question, but as I said, for transparency purposes, it might be good to put it in there. One can add that there would be certain, when one comes to the question of provinces, some provinces do not have this capacity for a complete internal audit unit, or some of them outsource it, some of them have shared functions, and they're talking about internal audit function there. But the standard along which that internal audit unit must function, the question is who established those standards. And rather than having that in the regulations to the PFMA, I'm suggesting we go to the executive authority, Speaker and the Chairperson Acting Joint. Honourable Chair, clause 56 is the next point. It's the same as what I've just said now. It's once again getting away from the PFMA regulations or the regulations to the PFMA. And rather just having the executive authority of Parliament determining that. So I can add that we're putting a lot of functions in the area of the executive authority, and obviously one will have to, those functions will have to be supported by the right administrative or the administrational structures in Parliament. Would have to assist with that, something like a budget office of some sort. Parliament has structures within its administration for at the moment, but I suppose it will have to be beefed up if one looks at the need to draft regulations. We really need to put it on paper there, and it must be published. The next amendment, Honourable Chair, is clause 64 on page 39. One of those issues where I would say that rationality, unfortunately, is not the first thing that jumps to mind. I mean, the provision reads, the accounting officer must comply with any request by Parliament, the Executive Authority, National Treasury, or the Auditor General. I'm not sure what it is that the National Treasury would want to request from the accounting officer, and whether we should have such a broad provision which says the accounting officer must comply with such request. As I say, I cannot actually sit here and give you a rational example. That is, maybe someone from finance can do that, or maybe Treasury can give us examples of why it would be necessary for National Treasury to have that power to request basically anything from the accounting officer of Parliament. It talks about other information within a chapter of general reporting responsibilities. Honestly, I think it's a sort of a catch-all clause, and one must request further information on that point. I think the more interesting amendments are, in my opinion, deleted the whole of clause 72, if I remember correctly. That, Honourable Chair, is application of the Public Finance Management Act. That reads now, and I propose that it deletes it. Parliament must comply with any provision of the PFMA applicable to it when this Act comes into effect, except to the extent that any such matter is dealt with in this Act. Once again, a bit of a catch-all clause. The PFMA has a similar provision in which says that it only applies to Parliament to the extent set out in the PFMA. So what we have is we have the PFMA with limited application on Parliament, and we're busy with this FOPLA bill. The question we have in FOPLA is, do we now remove all these references and separate FOPLA from the PFMA, or do we allow the integration to continue? And this clause allows integration to continue, while I thought there was instructions in any case to actually separate the two. So clause 72, the amendment proposed there, must be read with the next one. Now, those are the wording of the bill as it was published in the Government Gazette, where we are appealing certain provisions in the PFMA that refers to Parliament. So that was a bill published in the Government Gazette, which during the deliberations of the committee was then removed, and clause 72 inserted. So let's take up 72 and put back that original wording and create a separation between FAFLA and the PFMA. And in terms of the body of the bill, I was wondering whether we shouldn't refer to the Financial Management of Parliament Act 2008, should everything go according to schedule. I've proposed some amendments to Schedule 1, which is not just that is correct. That is correct. Honourable Chair, that is correct. Was a repeal of legislation. Repeal of legislation. In the committee's draft of 2 August. Exactly. The amendment in the schedule, norms and standards for provincial legislatures, I actually have a lot to say about that, but it's, obviously the provinces will have to come on board there. Looking at page 46, all I'm doing there is just removing any reference to the PFMA, because they're in a similar constitutional position as Parliament. I've also removed in K the reference to comply with the accounting standards issued by the Minister of Finance on advice of the Accounting Standards Board. The Accounting Standards Board, of course, is appointed by the Minister. That's much of the muchness, in my opinion, there is still a executive function that's coming into the domain of the procedures and proceedings of a legislature. I will check my side on the task that I was given. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, that's it, members. Now, let's take a discussion on this, and if possible, if we could go systematically through the bill. But a general question, and I see my co-chair here also wants to say something. But if I could just ask, you referred us to a section in the PFMA. I just want to be sure. Did members find that? You find that, because I just want to be sure exactly. But again, I'm coming, members. Yeah, I just want to clarify this thing so that we know we are all on the same page. That section of the PFMA, where you could be referred to, or you referred to us, because it's a general thing with regards to this relationship between this legislation and the PFMA. And the other thing is, the issue of the executive authority, the proper definition of the executive, where does it come from? Are we taking it from the Constitution? Are we taking it from the PFMA? But where does this executive? I know I actually joined the committee a little late on this when we dealt with it last time, so it would assist us also that, so that we are all on the same understanding. Because I want to avoid a situation where we have assigned a particular status to a particular structure in Parliament that might be inconsistent with either the Constitution or the PFMA. Yeah, can perhaps if you could deal with those, because I just brought them, then I'll ask Mr. Khalane also to ask his, and then I will take numbers.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The clause in the PFMI I was referring to, that's 3.2, clause 3.2, institutions to which this Act applies. And then that's now the PFMI. And the PFMI there says that this Act, to the extent indicated in the Act, applies to and one goes to the Parliament and the Provincial Legislature, subject to subsection 2. And subsection 2 sets out the clause I'm referring to. Says that to the extent that the provision of this Act applies to Parliament, any controlling and supervisory functions of the National Treasury in terms of that provision are performed by the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces acting jointly. Now, the PFMI as it is applies to a very limited extent to Parliament and the provincial legislature. There's a few references, I think clause 8, clause 13, or clause 11, clause 13 and so on. Those don't really affect Parliament. That's why one hears often in Parliament we're acting in the spirit of the PFMI. Because we don't act in terms of the left, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But can we just find the 3.2?
Page 14. In this little handout. This book that Treasury handout. Page 14. Section 3.2.
I got it from Bradley.
Cabinet can be removed by Parliament, if Parliament feels like that.
So there's a difference in nature. The terms, I don't see a problem with the terms, but as I say, it's a term that's used in the PFMA and it has been used in the context of Parliament. So, I think that answers those two questions, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm really not sure why you invited me to this meeting, because it does really constrain me engaging in this one. But let's really congratulate the Portfolio Committee for the substantial work done. Now, the only problem I really think we're going to have ourselves, the two things made that are challenges for us. First one is to sit and pretend that we're in isolation, and so deal with this legislation as if there are no legislatures coming from the NCOP now. I think that's the fundamental problem. And if we do that, it means we then just rubber stamp this as is, as the NCOP. But secondly, I thought we, in our old discussions, I suspect these are old discussions, and people have moved forward. We were always talking about some form of framework broadly that would then assist provinces to be able to deal with these matters. I'm not sure how we're going to deal with it from the point of view of the National Council of Provinces. But number two, similar pieces of legislation, I'm worried about how this one is going to be dealt with. Because normally the FFC has to comment on these kinds of pieces of legislation. Now, FFC is not the executive. It has to comment on these things. I'm not sure whether that has been done as part of the process for the FFC to comment. Now, and I'm just looking forward, therefore, to the engagement. And as I'm saying, I'm not sure how we're going to do it, Chair. You pass it yourselves, throw it to the NCOP, NCOP rubber stamps, or decide to say, well, what about the provincial issues and so on and so on, and open the whole big can of worms again. Because it would then mean changing the very first page, the objects under the to regulate the financial management of Parliament, etc., including regulate for financial management of Parliament and legislatures in a manner consistent with the, in other words, legislatures, wherever you refer to Parliament, must also refer to legislatures, etc., etc. And I'm just saying this is one angle which is a bit, we're unashamed about it, by the way. We want to raise it strongly as an NCOP company. And so if we're going to engage in this kind of a legislation that minus these issues, does create problems for us. For instance, if you refer, for instance, to just specific and general to the Minister of Finance, clearly in a legislature have got to refer to the MEC of Finance, for instance. I think these are some of the matters we might want to come back to specifically. Something on page one, therefore, for me, that critical issue must be resolved of Parliament and the legislature in a manner consistent with the status of the blah, 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 and therefore to provide again for the responsive, to ensure that all revenue expenditure, assets, liabilities of Parliament and legislatures are managed efficiently, etc., etc. I'm going back to the old discussion which you might have decided to throw away on that very first page, Chair. To regulate the financial management of Parliament and legislatures in a manner consistent, blah, 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 blah. Of course, it then comes back to the whole title, the Financial Management of Parliament Bill. It would mean, therefore, for me, it's the Financial Management of Parliament and Legislatures Bill.
Thank you.
I'm not sure, because I do not want Advocate Jenkins to answer questions that may not necessarily. Yeah, but it's up to you if you would want to. But, you know, I think the difficulty with this legislation is that because it has been in the shelf for too long, some of us have forgotten where we were, because the last time we worked on it in 2006, and so coming back to it now, was when the two committees were working together. So the product that we have is still the same product that came out there. The only thing that was being done now was to remove the PFME. So even the name to, you know, because there were some legal opinions with regards to whether this parliament can legislate for provinces, and that is why we end up with Schedule 1, which deals with the norms and standards for provincial legislatures, which came out as a result of engagement between the two committees. So, yeah, but I may not be fully conversant with that part of it because, like I said, I joined the committee a bit late, but it has been a process of the two committees, the same committee and the committee. But it's now, you know, since 2006, August. And one of the reasons why it was not passed on the 2nd of August, from the NA side, we had completed our work. But the reason why it was not passed was because we said we cannot pass this legislation until the Select Committee on Finance has its word. And if it needs to go back and consult in the provinces, we would allow that process to proceed from there. So I think that still holds. And, yeah. But let me take Mr. Mlodo, because we just want to clarify this part, and then we'll get a response from Mr. Let's take Mr. Mlodo, Ms. Fox, there was another Mr. Mare and Ms. Mare. Mr. Sogone also. Can you just leave that you
on this issue?
I think Mr. Haran is raising a far complex and bigger issue, which maybe we need to isolate and deal with it at a later stage. But obviously, I agree with him. There are a lot of complications here. One of the complications that is going to arise immediately is that each and every legislature is going to have its own legislation. Now, from the point of consistency, how do you monitor that? You fragment financial management into various provinces, and you find that the standards are not even the same. You can talk about the nominal standards in the schedule, but some of the finer details might start to negate those standards. I'm not an expert on this issue. And you create various boundaries with their own legislation. Seriously, honestly speaking. That's just my honest opinion. Then you have got various boundaries there. I'm not saying provinces are boundaries, but I'm just saying, you know, the impression of financial management that I'm gathering, that we'll be creating throughout the country. Various pieces of legislation on financial management. And that's my biggest problem. But coming to the submission, I mean, to this legislation, my other concern on the first point that Mr. Jenkins raised, you know, of preparing a budget, Parliament's budget must be in accordance with the format prescribed by the executive authority. It goes back to the matter that has been raised by Mr. Alan. In a format prescribed by the executive authority, you know, and the PFMA, I'm not saying we shouldn't be stretching our mind and giving powers to Parliament where adequate, but the PFMA had certain format, which is consistent throughout government. Now, I still have to be convinced to what extent would that format compromise the independence of Parliament, of the separation of powers argument. Because surely you need to have a format that would, one, enhance transparency and comparability. How then do you exercise oversight of a format that's not consistent throughout? I'm not sure. I'm just throwing. I don't have answers to this question. So it's going to be a problem. Finally, when National Treasury, on behalf of government, consolidate all their accounts and say these are the accounts of government. You know, of all these fears or whatever. Okay, these are the accounts, and you've got different formats. Now, how do you put that type of the statement of national accounts together when the farmers are not talking to each other? I'm saying, let's be cautious and debate this issue thoroughly, so that I understand the issue of separation of powers. I respect it. But at the same time, we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater with the baby inside and take out the good things that are there in the PFMA. I understand the separation of powers, we must respect it. But let's just not say everywhere where the PFMA is mentioned, throw it out and throw out even the good things. That's just my concern.
Ms. Fox?
Yes, Chair. One or two things. I hope we're not looking at a third copy of the PFMA, but on page 8, page 8 of the copy I'm holding, there is the reference to the executive authority.
Let me come and just immediately draw that to your attention. On the one that is deformed we're talking about, it just moves from page 4 to 15. So pages 5 14 are missing on this one. So that's the problem. So if you refer to that one, if you could just read it for us so that we understand what you're referring to.
That's the,
and then maybe we would need to find a way now of seeing how we're going to augment the missing pages on this one.
That's the addition.
On the page,
The missing page could be $100 bill.
That's the addition for opposition parties, Chair.
Okay, Ms. Fox.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. The executive authority here, which I'm sure is the one which was referred to here by our legal state law advisor, as it were, refers to A, B, and C, and there's a reference to national departments, referring to members, cabinet members, provincial departments, executive council members, and then national public entities. The cabinet member who's accountable to Parliament for that public entity, etc. And on page 9, it then refers to the provincial lot. Nowhere does it refer to Parliament as the executive authority, unless, of course, there is the third version. So that was the first difference of opinion that I did want to clarify. I did look at the Constitution to see how it referred to Parliament and its executive authority. There are points under the financial clauses with that reference. Otherwise, there is not. However, within the Constitution itself, it also does indicate that the joint rules of Parliament are effectively covered by the Constitution. And perhaps the executive authority is defined in the joint rules of Parliament. I don't know, Chair. I don't have that with me. So I think that's the first clarification I seek, because no, it is not in the PFMA version that I have. The second one, I don't know if I should just start.
What part of the Constitution are you referring to, Ms. Fox?
Well, I'm saying in the references to Parliament under the Constitution, the pages there would be probably round about 53. Let me see.
Section?
Yes. It's chapter 5, I know, but I'm just, there's a reference to an actual page, you see. Now, I didn't quite have that page on me. But it's actually at the beginning rather than that. So all of us do have what you call it an index. And alphabetically then, it's page 42. So if you've got the index. Page 42, Jim. And we do begin to see some of that coming out there. So I don't know if there was this broad reference there that was covered, but there's no reference here to executive authority. That's the point I'm trying to make. But then there is a reference to executive authority under finance, the finance section. So I'm really seeking a clarification. Are we going to say that implicit in the Constitution is an acknowledgement that the joint rules of Parliament, would govern this? Because within the joint rules of Parliament, I believe the executive authority has been defined, but I haven't seen it. Now, that's my first clarification or requirement there. I see I've also put page 125. I wonder why I did that under the Constitution.
Yeah.
Chair. Yes, under finance, there is a reference here on page 125. That was the one I mentioned. But then if we can come to the other clarifications I would appreciate. On the Constitution, got here page 37, RSA, and then page 40, with reference to clauses 17 and 22. I have to go through, this is a huge bill, Chair, as you know. 37 here. I wish they'd made it a bit bigger. It must be about 8 points or something. But maybe it's on this page here, 37 in this area here, Chair. Oh, it's the PFMA. Right. But in these clauses, in the reference here, the reference on 17 and 22 are this in. It's in the PFMA, it's the clauses rather. There's a reference to the annual budget and the adjustments budget. And if you look under the annual budget here on page 37 of the PFMA, clause 27 there, it does talk about the minister must table the annual budget. It's cross-referenced here, the reference to Treasury having that authority. On the other hand, under 40, we have a slightly different approach to the adjustments, where we talk about may. So it's not a must. Now, the question that would arise to me here with Parliament, the Minister has no choice. He must table this before the for a financial year, at the beginning of that financial year, etc., and it's covered so in the Constitution, whereas the adjustments is not there. Yet, under the adjustments in Parliament, there's pretty much of a choice as to whether they will do this or will do that. It's not in consultation. It's after having a chat to the minister, then decisions are taken. So which aspect of the Constitution would apply? That appertaining to Treasury, Finance, or Parliament? Or will the joint rules override the Constitution? Right. Then the other aspect would be more of a philosophical one regarding clause 64 here, where National Treasury was included in this request for documents. I don't quite regard that, you know, to me, this is not entirely a constitutional issue by saying there's a separation of powers, because if you take the broad understanding implicit in the Constitution, all agencies, departments, and so on receiving funds from the taxpayer must take the economy of the country into account, you know, etc., etc. Now, that's covered in the Constitution. Now, one could imagine a situation, hypothetically very much so, but hypothetical situations have a way of becoming reality, in which Parliament tells Treasury after a chat, we're not too sure what we will be requisitioning the next quarter. We haven't got worked out the figures yet. And then we go for a tumble in the economy, and finally Parliament works out what it requires and tells Treasury, well, we will be requisitioning $3 billion this month. You know, you can have a practical difficulty. Parliament would be legally empowered to do that because it does not need Treasury's agreement. It's only after consultation. So that's what I called it a philosophical discussion. Because quite clearly, we wouldn't want any constitutional crisis arising out of sloppy legislation.
Mr. Madden?
Thank you, Chair. I think he's, Scott said, I think it links to what my concerns are as well. What I want to ask first is, you know, the problem with in consultation and after consultation, with the specific problems experienced, the specific problems that you foresee, because in the one instance we say that, you know, we don't really need the approval of the minister because, you know, it's only consulting, but then, you know, everything gets sent through to National Treasury and they must just do as Parliament has instructed them, basically. But eventually the minister is held accountable for what happens in Treasury. And I'm concerned about that, because on page 17, that second adjustment or, you know, the amendment that you have made, the minister don't have to agree to a date, and there can be, you know, Parliament can do whatever they want to. They can even delay the process if they want to, and eventually it impacts on financial management via Treasury, and I'm concerned to see, you know, how that what you are proposing can enhance first of all the separation of powers, but also financial management, and the executive authority is very subjective, and I don't think there's any indications that I've seen where it states that the executive authority must have certain structures to support them and to do certain things. So if it's a lay person, they can apply their mind and they can give instructions in terms of spending money. I don't think that's the intent of this all, but it is obviously things that can happen. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Fogart.
Thank you, Colonel Chairperson. No, it's fine. I'm so happy that I spoke after your co-chairperson has spoken, because I kept on consulting with my colleague here that you also clarified, when did we last had discussed this? Because now I see we're discussing amendments. I thought that I was the only one who was lost. Because I hope that we will respond to what Comrade Khalane was raising in terms of now we're finding ourselves here. And I know that the last time, maybe from the NSOP side, maybe we were together the last time when we were dealing with this piece of legislation, there were certain things that we thought that were not covered by the legislation, which led to the suspension of the whole thing. Now, we're not mentioning anything about those things. Now, that kind of confuses me. Having said that, the chairperson, I don't know. I think that also when I see here a reference to executive authority, I'm just thinking of some inconsistency that perhaps could bring in, because Parliament elsewhere speaks about oversight authority, and here we're referring to executive authority. Maybe there might be inconsistencies then if we don't have one understanding of what is it that we're talking about. But generally, also, my observation, I see that I've not come across a requirements for reports of your quarterly report, for instance. I'm not sure whether it's because, or perhaps, the feeling was that they are not necessary or what. I think that now I'm not very sure whether maybe we need to, as the process, I'm just a bit what to call it, I would really like for guidance, whether we need to go into these amendments that were read, and what are we going to do about it? I think that some of us would have loved to also attend to other things that I noticed here. Comrade Khalane has started. I just need your guidance.
Okay. You know, I think there's going to be a bit of a problem. You know, the committee still has to deal with two reports where we're going to be going through. which are going to be debated tomorrow. I had thought that this, the instruction was clear that was given to Advocate Jenkins. Take this bill, go and clean it up, because there is a lot of cross-referencing to the PFMA. If there is anything in the PFMA that this bill was to accommodate, just write it in the bill. And I think that's what we have done. And we said we'll reopen the process, and that is why we have agreed that we will take National Treasury's submission on Friday. And I think with that information, it's going to be then up to these two committees to decide how then do we take the process forward. Because out of that submission, I have no doubt, we haven't seen it, but I have no doubt that it will reopen the entire bill. Because if we had wanted to proceed with this bill, we would have just said, because when we suspended it for the NCOP to finalize its side. We had actually gone through the bill clause by clause and adopted the bill on the 2nd of August. And once we had been working with the NCOP, but on that day, because we didn't have the NCOP, and we said there was a section that needs to look into issues of provinces, let's suspend adopting the bill, because we would want the NCOP to have an input on the part that deals with provinces. That's the only part that actually still needed attention. But here we are. We have reopened the process. Because we had not adopted the bill. So there is nothing wrong in doing that. And that is why we're saying, perhaps now that we have done the cleaning part of it, let's listen to National Treasury on Friday. Somebody recommended that somebody has not, been consulted. I can't remember which. You mentioned the FFC. Because it's been available, the FFC, it's been available ever since. And should they want to comment, especially on the provincial part of it, I would imagine we should accept that. But then let's take a decision once we have listened to National Treasury's submission on Friday. I had Mr. Mgun. I'm just raising these things because maybe the answers are not going to assist us go forward. We can address some of them, but they're not going to assist us go forward until such time that we have had all the other views. I had Mr. Mgun that I had recognized, Mr. Singh, and then Mr. Mabe.
Just a point of clarification, sir. Actually, the thing of the excessive authority is not in the bill. There's a governance model document that we're given about chairs of in Parliament, where they're explaining the governance, the excessive authority, the excessive oversight committee. So that's where they take the thing from. So in the bill, they refer to that excessive authority from that document of a new governance model of Parliament. I think that's where it comes from.
Thanks. At least somebody still remembers where these things came from, because... Okay. You know, some of these things, when they talk about them, it's as if they don't have authors, and some of the authors are still in this room. Okay. Let's take Mr. Singh.
Thank you, Chair. Very quickly, I'm not going to belabor the point. But just to say, I support your proposal. Let's listen to National Treasury. We all have our particular views. Mine is that, the separation of powers is something else, but the PFMA... The intentions of the PFMA is to ensure good financial management. And why shouldn't we have PFMA governing anybody where public monies are involved? But that's, by the way, let's hear Treasury. Let's see what they say, and let's take it from there.
Thanks, Ms. Mami.
Yeah, thanks, Chip. It's very interesting to see how divergent we are in our views. When it comes to separation of powers, I'm one of those who want us to observe separation of powers. And I wouldn't be comfortable that Parliament must subscribe to PFMA. But I was just saying that you are so divergent in our views. And you see, one other thing that I wanted to, I'm happy that you clarified it, the process, because where we left off last time was that the NCOP in consultation with the provinces, because we can't leave the provinces, just out in the cold. There was supposed to be that kind of consultation so that as the bill is tabled, then we would know what then should be the next step forward. And we indicated that it's important that we can't keep this bill in the cupboard, any longer. It needs to come out into the public, and whatever changes needs to be made should be made once it's a bill that is before Parliament.
and Parliament has to finalize. Because in other processes, for instance, with the Auditor General, Parliament from time to time, it's either it will be disqualified on the fact that it hasn't finalized this bill, or the Auditor General, every year, the Auditor General refers to this bill that it's still not out to govern the finances of Parliament, and where is Parliament with the process. But finally, on the Audit Committee, to whom is it accountable? Because I think that part, even the Audit Committee itself has a problem of to whom does it account, so it should be clarified. Thank you.
You want to have a few words quickly, and then I want us to close this thing. Okay.
Chair, thank you very much. I'll do this quick, so I won't go into unnecessary detail. The issue of provincial legislatures is an issue that's been discussed on administrative level between the legal advisors of the different provincial legislatures. There's some drafts out, but two things I need to say there. One is that the Constitution says national legislation must determine. Okay, so the Parliament has the power, has the authority to make such legislation. The issue that will come forward is the classification of this legislation. The Constitution also says that a bill that has any provision in, this is an amendment, any provision in that affects the financial interests of provinces and that's provided for in Chapter 30 must be 76. So if we have the bill as it stands at the moment, with norms and standards, my opinion on that is that it's a 76 bill. The provinces should be consulted. The alternative to this would be the PFMA way to go. The PFMA way, not the substance but the procedure of it. So we have a 75 bill that provides only for Parliament, and we have a 76 amendment that provides for provinces, and it becomes one bill after this. But that's a question in terms of how do we take this forward. But the provincial issue loom large. The other issue I wanted to say, Mr. Khalani, is that the MCOP must also think about, and this will come out after Friday, the oversight mechanisms created by this bill. And one of them is the Committee on Public Accounts. Now, the Committee on Public Accounts is a National Assembly Committee. And the question is that sufficient for the NCOP? The NCOP has a separate authority in terms of the Constitution to determine its internal proceedings and arrangements. So if they are happy that the audit report goes to a committee of the National Assembly, then it is in order. I mean, the NCOP can pass such legislation, but the NCOP can also say, we also want a bite of that audit report, please. Okay. In terms of the separation of powers and the format of accounts, and whether if one says that the format of that account may be or must be determined in consultation with the Minister of Finance, and whether that infringes on the principle of separation, of the doctrine of separation of powers. Yes, that is it's an academic question, Chair. If one looks at what can be prescribed in a format, then certainly it can infringe on that. I mean, certain questions can arise to say, look, you need to set out exactly how do you spend certain monies, which is a line item at this point, but we want to see exactly who travels where, when, what did you do there, and we want an audit on those. And those things can come up, but it's an academic one at this point in time. The question of the executive authority has come up a few times. I can only say that the specific definition of executive authority as it applies in the FOPLA bill, that definition of executive authority is found in the FOPLA bill. Now, whether executive authority and Honorable FOPLA, I don't think it's defined in the joint rules at all. I don't think so. The Constitution doesn't give us much. The PFMA doesn't do this for Parliament. So we're doing it in the FOPLA bill. And as I say, the old Exchequer Act of 1975 has a reference to the executive authority as well, but I'm under the impression it's not defined there either. But they referred to the Speaker as the executive authority then, but it was a different system altogether in 1975. There was a question about the must introduce a budget, may introduce an adjustment. That will be a constitutional crisis. Parliament says, please, we want more money, we want this adjustment appropriation. And the Minister of Finance says, well, I'm not going to do it. In terms of the Constitution, only the Minister of Finance may introduce the money bill. So there we have the system. It's what I would call, in academic terms, a healthy democratic battle. but it can lead to a problematic situation. It could lead to a constitutional crisis, and we've seen this in America, where Congress does not want to approve a budget, and the whole state system comes to a halt. And if it doesn't resolve itself very quickly, then there are problems because nobody gets paid. That's the problem. And then the issue of in consultation and after consultation, and that we don't see the need, or we think it's not necessary to change that, and the executive authority is subjective. It is an inherent in the nature of Parliament that this issue will arise. Now, one must draw the distinction between a government department that, to receive its budget, it must get approval from National Treasury, it must get approval from the Minister of Finance, and Parliament. Parliament has an executive authority which doubles up as the Treasury of Parliament. that is interesting, but the nature of Parliament is such that we have multi-party politics in Parliament, and it's an open Parliament in terms of the Constitution. So whereas in a governance department you don't have multiple parties to question and to raise things and to speak to the media, in Parliament you have that. So, and ultimately, the 5-year election cycle, if Parliament abuses its power, that is the final control over Parliament. So those are just things to keep in mind. The issue of quarterly reports, Mr. Tegoni, is in the section clause 52. There's also provision for monthly reports and, of course, the annual reports and so on. So there is a reporting function there. I may also add, Honourable Chair, that it will not be the executive authority who decides on the budget of Parliament. When one looks at the provisions of the bill, the administration must draft the budget, present it to the executive authority. The executive authority must take that budget and table it and refer it to a joint committee that must be established. That joint committee will then report on it, and the houses will have to adopt the budget. If that allays any of those fears. Honourable Singh spoke about the separation of powers, and Honourable Mabe about the provinces. I think I've dealt just roughly with that. I'll keep it short. If you want further details, I can carry on. This is if I can just say about the provinces, the question that arose in 2006 was, of course, should we proceed with this or not? Provinces themselves at one point indicated that it's not enough detail in the bill. They want more detail. Now, that is an issue for later determination, but the worry that the provinces are going to start determining their own is both real, because I think one or two provinces have provided for legislation like that. But secondly, there will be people who differ from my opinion, but legally I think they do not have the constitutional authority to provide for their financial arrangements in the sense that Section 215 of the Constitution envisages. Thank you.
Okay, we'll meet again on Friday on this matter, and take the venue is where the program will be found. Where's the program? So whilst you're looking for the program, I think that let's really not lose sight of what Mr. Mloto is saying. Well, part of the bigger challenge is that I think we should not rush. You know, provincial finances are problematic as we speak. And so if we really want to rush and create other monsters that would create problems and issues of collapse in provinces, you don't want to see provinces go the Section 100 route as a result of our own kind of actions. I'm saying, let's really take into consideration the issues that are raised, fundamental issues of consistency. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, I said we meet again on Friday. The venue is V475. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of this session. Thank you. Members, we now move on to the two reports. The report on our budget hearings for Budget Bill 7 and 11. We start with 7. The reports have been circulated. That members have got them now. Uh, Yeah. Can I then request that this becomes a very closed session?
What is meant by that?
That is members of the Portfolio Committee on Finance and staff of the Portfolio Committee.
And other members of Parliament who are interested.
And the representative of the executive authority.